Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
In 1969, a plan to show support for an anti-racism protest turned the lives of 14 promising black student athletes upside down. Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story. Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and in the early hours of Monday, the 12th of February, these are our main stories. NATO's Secretary General has rebuked Donald Trump for suggesting that he'd encourage Russia to attack any member of the alliance that hadn't paid its bills. The US President Joe Biden has urged Israel's Prime Minister in a phone call not to launch an offensive on Rafah without a plan to protect more than a million civilians there. And Kyiv says it has evidence that Russian troops are using Elon Musk's Starlink satellite internet service in occupied parts of Ukraine. Also coming up in this podcast.
She's very much learnt that she needs to stand next to him at the feed bucket in order to kind of have her focus. And from there, she will very quickly take the fish. But she is definitely much more secure by having him next to her.
We'll tell you about squid, the partially sighted penguin that's found a friend at feeding time. Let's start, though, with NATO's Secretary General, who has issued a stern rebuke to Donald Trump for suggesting that he would encourage Russia to attack members of the alliance who don't pay their dues. Jens Stoltenberg said the words of the former US president, who is running for office again this year, could undermine security and put soldiers at risk. Mr. Stoltenberg insisted that the alliance stood by its commitment to defend any member that was attacked. The White House has described Mr. Trump's comments made at a campaign rally on Saturday as appalling and unhinged. Here's our security correspondent, Frank Gardner.
Donald Trump's comments are, on the face of it, shocking and destabilising. The notion of a potential future US president encouraging Russia to attack a NATO country has prompted swift rebukes. The White House called it appalling and unhinged. NATO Secretary General felt obliged to issue a statement reassuring the world that nothing had changed, that the alliance still stood by its commitment to defend all members if they were attacked. So what exactly did the former president and now presidential hopeful say? This was Donald Trump speaking at a rally in South Carolina, addressing a favourite issue of his, how some NATO members are failing to spend the agreed 2% of GDP on defence.
They asked me that question. One of the presidents of a big country stood up and said, "Well, sir, if we don't pay and we're attacked by Russia, will you protect us?" I said, "You didn't pay? You're delinquent?" He said, "Yes, let's say that happened. No, I would not protect you. In fact, I would encourage them to do whatever the hell they want. You got to pay. You got to pay your bill."
This is, of course, typical Trump fare. Say something provocative, outrage your critics, revel in the headlines, and delight your supporters. There are plenty of Americans on both sides of the political divide who struggle to see why the US should be paying such a huge bill for NATO when so many other members are failing to reach the required 2%. These are dangerous times for the alliance. The Baltic states are convinced that once President Putin has achieved his war aims in Ukraine, he will turn his attention to them. Doubts sown by Donald Trump could be just enough to convince the Kremlin that a future President Trump would not, after all, come to the defence of a fellow NATO member. And that is exactly what can lead to fatal miscalculations.
Frank Gardner reporting. Ukraine next. Almost since it started, the conflict in the country has been a focus for technical innovation, drones in particular. Well, another piece of technology used by Ukraine has been the Starlink system for satellite internet connection. It's built by SpaceX, which is a company owned by the billionaire Elon Musk. But now it's been alleged that Russian troops have been using Starlink, something Mr. Musk had said would not happen. So what is Starlink? That's a question I put to our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss.
Starlink is a system of over 5,000 satellites which are in low orbit. They were sent up there to provide internet access to places which previously couldn't get it. It's quite simple. The signal's beamed up from your computer or your mobile phone up to the satellite and then bounced to an internet service provider. This, of course, is very useful for countries which don't have much in the way of internet infrastructure, no broadband pipes, perhaps. But also it could be useful in a technically advanced country like the United States, where there are rural areas, places in the middle of nowhere where they don't have the internet. It was launched in 2019 and so far has proved rather successful. It has over 2 million subscribers, a turnover of more than $1 billion. And Elon Musk, who runs the company, says that it's already making a slight profit.
Now, as I'm sitting here listening, I recall that sometimes you can actually look up and see a string of the Starlink satellites in the sky on a clear night, can't you? But how has that become part of the Ukraine war?
Once the war started, Russia made a beeline for attacking Ukraine's infrastructure, gas, electricity, but also the internet. So Ukraine asked Elon Musk, can you allow us to use Starlink so we can still have the internet? At first, he did so as a gift. He gave out free subscriptions and free equipment. Later, the US Defense Department agreed to fork out the money to keep Starlink going in Ukraine. And it has been very useful for civilians, but also for the military. We know that during the battles of Mariupol and Azovstal, for example, the troops kept in contact using Starlink. But it's supposed to be for only one side. You can't buy Starlink equipment in Russia. And even if you could, the satellites don't cover Russia, so they wouldn't work. But we've recently seen allegations that Russian soldiers have been using Starlink in Ukrainian territory they occupy. And on Sunday, the Ukrainian intelligence agency said they've got proof of this. They intercepted a call between two soldiers who said they'd been using this equipment. They could have either taken it from captured Ukrainian soldiers or bought it via a third country.
And Elon Musk, who I think controls Starlink because he controls SpaceX, which started Starlink, what does he have to say about these allegations?
Well, it's interesting because SpaceX have continued to deny that Starlink is available in Russia, but they haven't said whether it works in Russian-occupied Ukraine, and it's possible that non-denial speaks volumes. I should say that Starlink has been controversial from the start. You mentioned those lights in the sky. Astronomers claimed it would cause light pollution. And then, after Israel wiped out the internet in Gaza at one point, people asked if Starlink would be provided to Gaza to replace it, and Elon Musk said he would only do it if the Israelis agreed. Now, I have to say, this is a man who is, to say the least, no stranger to controversy. It's unlikely that this latest controversy with Ukraine is really going to bother him.
Paul Moss. Finland's conservative former Prime Minister Alexander Stubb has won the country's presidential election. As we record this podcast, with most of the votes counted, his Green Party rival, the former Foreign Minister Pekka Haavisto, has admitted defeat. Here's Steve Jackson.
This is the first presidential poll since Finland joined NATO last year. Mr. Stubb is a strong supporter of Ukraine and has taken a hardline approach towards Russia, with which Finland shares a 1,300-kilometre border. This matters because the Finnish head of state is directly responsible for foreign and security policy and is commander-in-chief of the country's armed forces. The outgoing president, Sauli Niinistö, who is stepping down, was at one point given the nickname the Putin Whisperer because of his relationship with the Russian leader and the softer stance he took towards Moscow.
Next to Gaza. The US President Joe Biden has spoken by telephone to Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for the first time since he described Israel's military response in Gaza as, quote, over the top. The White House says Mr. Biden reiterated that Israel shouldn't proceed with an offensive in the city of Rafah without plans to ensure the safety of over 1 million civilians there. Aid agencies have warned that an assault on Rafah would be catastrophic. The city in southern Gaza is now home to many Palestinians who were told to flee to the area since the fighting started last October. Israel's Prime Minister has said, though, he's determined to launch the offensive into Rafah, but is making plans for the evacuation of civilians. Speaking to ABC television in the United States, Benjamin Netanyahu said he would ensure safe passage for the civilian population to leave.
Victory is within reach. We're going to do it. We're going to get the remaining Hamas terrorist battalions in Rafah, which is the last bastion. But we're going to do it. And in this, I agree with the Americans. We're going to do it while providing safe passage for the civilian population so they can leave.
For many people, though, the situation in the south of Gaza is now extremely difficult. Tom White, who is a director of the UN agency in Gaza, UNRWA, explained how difficult it would be to move Palestinian refugees sheltering in Rafah.
The only really what we can see feasible access out of the city will probably be along the coast road, and trying to move a million people and a humanitarian operation up a country road is just not going to be feasible. The conditions in Rafah haven't improved. You know, essentially you've got a town that used to have 280,000 people living in it. Now around 1.4 million people are living in Rafah. People don't have enough water. There's a lack of access to sanitation. You know, we're starting to get enough food to people, but, you know, living conditions are very tough.
Well, for more on that call, I spoke to our correspondent Will Vernon, who's in Washington, D.C., and he told us that the White House has made it clear they would not support a military operation without a plan for civilian safety.
We know that President Biden did reaffirm his view that an Israeli military operation in the city of Rafah, this is where hundreds of thousands, over a million Palestinian civilians are sheltering, that that should not go ahead without proper planning to ensure that the civilians sheltering there are not harmed. Now, Washington has been warning for a number of days that going into Rafah unprepared would be a disaster. The UN has said this as well. Aid agencies have said it would be a catastrophe. And Mr. Biden said that again today to Mr. Netanyahu on the call. And generally, Mr. Biden has been kind of slowly ramping up his rhetoric over the last few weeks when talking about the Israeli military operation. On Thursday, President Biden said that that offensive was over the top, which is his harshest criticism yet, really, of his Israeli ally.
Can I talk to you about domestic politics on the US side as the election cycle really takes hold? How much of an issue, or perhaps a better way of saying it, is how much pressure is President Biden facing because of his ongoing and resolute support for what Israel's government is doing?
I think that President Biden's under huge pressure over this issue. You know, this is made all the more complicated by the fact that it is an election year here, a particularly closely fought, polarized election campaign, or at least it's shaping up to be that way. President Biden has been criticized by Republicans, who some of whom say that, you know, he's not going far enough in his support of Israel. But most importantly, he's come under attack both from progressives within his own party, saying that, you know, the U.S. should be putting more pressure on Israel to reduce the impact on civilians in Gaza, but also amongst key groups of voters, right? For example, there is the U.S. state of Michigan. That is a key swing state, one of the states that Mr. Biden has to win if he has any hope of staying in the White House come November. And in Michigan, there are large groups of Arab Americans. So their votes will be key in determining the U.S. presidential election. And there's no greater prize than that.
Will Vernon in Washington, D.C. Well, let's stay with our reporting of the war between Israel and Hamas, because Garda Uda is a translator and freelance journalist who's from Gaza. She lived in Gaza City until the fighting forced her to move south, first to Khan Yunis and now to Rafah. My colleague James Menendez asked her what the situation there is like at the moment.
More than 1.5 million Palestinians believed to be in Rafah now. Actually, we can hear some airstrikes. Maybe they are east of Rafah, or maybe between areas between Khan Yunis and Rafah. It can be heard like every hour. And people, you know, they are so scared, like they have to evacuate for many, many times. And this is the last stage. So the situation here is so horrible.
And what do people think about the idea of having to move again? Because many people who, as I understand it, who are living in Rafah have already had to move from other places, including Gaza City.
Yeah, people actually start to flee to areas west of Khan Yunis, which is being considered as a safe place. Actually, they start to leave today, some of them.
Right, so people aren't waiting to find out when that military offensive will begin. They're just leaving already.
Yeah, because Israeli army, they have threatened that they will do some ground invasion near to this area. So people are preparing themselves to flee, taking some of their essential with them.
Is aid getting through to people in Rafah at the moment? I mean, have people got enough to eat, for example?
Yeah, actually, Rafah crossing is open and people can have some humanitarian aid from the crossing. So still they have a good supplement like food, like water. At least it's enough, but not like the north area.
And where are you living at the moment? Are you staying with family, with friends?
Yeah, I've been like in Khan Yunis for 3 months, and now I'm moving like since 3 weeks to my relative's home in Rafah. So I'm staying with three families, and we are more than 20 people inside one home.
Right, and it's a proper apartment, is it? It's not a tent.
Yes.
Yeah. And what about you? I mean, you're from Gaza City, and that's where you normally live. Do you know what's happened to your home there? I mean, is it still there?
Well, it's in east of Jabalia, actually, my home, and it was targeted. Last news we've been hearing from friends over there, it was partially destroyed, and all the area have been destroyed. My other sister houses, my cousins, my uncles, all of their houses have been destroyed.
Well, that was Garda Ouda, originally from Gaza City, but now living in Rafah. Change of pace now. Io Capitano is one of the five films nominated for Best International Feature Film at the Oscars next month. It's the story of what happens to two teenagers after they leave home in Senegal, hoping to migrate to Italy. Vincent Dowd spoke to the film's director and to one of the people who inspired the movie.
My name is Matteo Garrone, and I'm the director of Io Capitano.
I am Mamadou Kwasi, one of the protagonists of the film Io Capitano.
Assalamu alaikum sunu mami. Ñu ngi leen nuyu bu baax. Na dañuy waaja dem ben voyage.
Matteo Garrone is one of Italy's best known directors for, among other hits, the crime drama Gomorra. He says Io Capitano can be enjoyed as an adventure story about how a Senegalese teenager pilots a boat full of migrants across the Mediterranean. But he has political points to make too.
I decided to make this movie because we wanted to give a visual form to a part of a journey that we usually don't see. We see only the last part on television when the boat arrives in Sicily and the count of the people alive and dead, and we don't know what happened before.
Mamadou Kouassi, who now lives near Naples, provided much of the inspiration for the film with the real-life journey he made about 15 years ago.
This movie is telling about my story from the beginning, that me and my cousin, we decided to leave from Africa to Europe, crossing the Mediterranean Sea. I thought that in the desert, people are dying, dead bodies on the desert, and we face people that rob us. We have been maltreated, tortured every day in the prison in Libya, and we have been even been sold like slaves there.
The journey from Senegal to the coast of Sicily at times looks beautiful, despite its rigors. But scenes in a sadistically run prison in Libya show the hero, Musa, quickly abandoning his naivety.
It's a coming-of-age story. So it's a boy that starts as a boy, and during this odyssey, he became a man.
What's the enemy in the film?
Well, it's quite evident. The movie talks about the desire of this two young boy to discover the world in a system of people that try to exploit them. So the main character is a contemporary hero that fight for a rights that should be of everyone, the rights of move, the rights of desire to look for a better life. It's a battle against a system of death.
The language is mainly Wolof. The two young actors are likable, but Mamadou Kouassi knows real-life stories like his are controversial for many Italians. The Italian Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, has described immigration as a battle for Italy and Europe. You've made a very good film, but the politicians are the people who have to sort out a really difficult problem. So how do you think your film at least is a contribution to that?
This film is an instrument to change the policy, giving chance to people to travel free, give freedom to people to travel, because this also will help people to avoid trafficking in the desert, in the Mediterranean Sea, and also in the prison.
Barcelona. The film's now up for an Academy Award. Matteo Garrone says, win or not, he hopes it will change the perspectives of the young in particular.
In Italy, we have bring the movie to many, many schools, to many students. So it's also an opportunity for the young that don't go to see the movie in theater to realize behind this number there are kids like them.
Matteo Garrone, director of the film Il Capitano, ending that report by Vincent Dowd. Still to come.
We have a stretch of coastline of approximately 15 kilometres that's impacted. We have been into one lagoon that is seriously affected.
We hear from the Chief Minister of Tobago and see how the clearing up operation is going on.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
I'm Una Chaplin, and from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service, this is Hollywood Exiles. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Next, let's go to Pakistan. That was the sound of some demonstrations outside an election commission office in Karachi on Sunday. Supporters of the former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan were protesting about delays in the declaration of results from last Thursday's election. They allege vote rigging. The police have warned against unlawful assemblies or demonstrations around government offices. Pakistan now faces further political uncertainty as coalition negotiations continue. There was no outright winner in the vote. Candidates who support Mr. Khan, who was jailed in the run-up to the election, emerged with the most seats, 93 out of the 264 available. I heard from our correspondent in Islamabad, Caroline Davies.
The protest that we went over to today was relatively small, so we're not seeing mass, enormous demonstrations happening across the whole of Pakistan. What we are seeing is these small demonstrations that are coming out in some of the cities, a few hundred people at each of them. But clearly those are also not being tolerated by the police. We've seen, well, today when I was in Rawalpindi outside the Election Commission, where some of Imran Khan's supporters arrived and were protesting, again, a few hundred. After about an hour and a half, they were dispersed with tear gas. So they're clearly not being tolerated, being able to gather. But I think what we're also seeing is a gathering of resentment that's building on social media as well. And what will be really interesting is whether or not that spills over as things develop in the course of the next few days.
And following on from that long delay about declaring the results, is there any sense of suspicion, any doubt about the results? And if so, how widespread is that?
Yes, I think the fact that there was such a delay has left this space for people to make more and more accusations, that they think that this was essentially, in their words, a fixed match, that people knew what the results were going to be and they don't trust the results. And obviously the authorities have come back and said that's not true, but I think that that is going to be a real issue here, because I think that is a narrative that a lot of people are talking about. The fact that the powerful Pakistan military has often been involved or seen to be involved in politics, despite the fact that they say they're not, and the political parties that are perceived to be their favoured candidates always say that they've not done a deal with them. That's always generally been what people think has happened when they see an election. Now, the fact that we are now seeing this delay, the fact that that's also the backdrop, people are talking about it and talking about it fairly openly as well.
And the political machinations, I understand negotiations are now underway involving, you know, a former prime minister who's in jail, so he doesn't have any personal role to play. Lots of parties with acronyms. I mean, what's going on in terms of the next hours, the next few days, the next week or so in terms of what the outcome possibly could be?
The biggest development that we've seen this evening is the fact that we've had confirmation that senior leadership from Nawaz Sharif's party have met senior leadership from Bilawal Bhutto's party. He is the son of assassinated Benazir Bhutto, the former prime minister here in Pakistan. Those two parties have had their senior leadership meet to discuss the potential of forming a government, and those are now formal talks. There was video put out earlier of the two sides greeting each other incredibly warmly. Now, this wouldn't be entirely new for these parties because they were previously in a coalition government after they ousted Imran Khan from power, and they then ruled the country as a coalition up until August last year. So that might be something that we see developing. They haven't announced that they are forming a government, but the fact that they are publicly meeting and, as I say, warmly welcoming each other is being seen as very significant here.
Caroline Davis in Pakistan. The United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, has warned that nearly 70,000 children in western Nepal need further humanitarian aid following November's devastating earthquake. Molly Perella has more.
The appeal from UNICEF comes 100 days on from what was Nepal's deadliest earthquake in 8 years. Many people have spent the harsh winter in makeshift shelters. The agency warned that young people were still dealing with the trauma of losing loved ones. It said their development was at risk because they had lost their belongings and their homes and schools had been damaged. UNICEF said children needed normalcy so they could begin to heal. It's appealing for more than $14 million in funding to help rebuild the lives of those affected.
Molly Perella. Now, in an earlier podcast, we reported on the news from Trinidad and Tobago that hundreds of volunteers there have been helping efforts to clean up a huge oil spill caused by a ship that overturned after hitting a coral reef. The oil has affected 15 kilometres of the coastline, damaging beaches and reaching a protected mangrove swamp. It should be the time of year when many tourists visit the islands to enjoy the sunshine and the clear blue waters. Well, my colleague James Menendez spoke to Farley Augustine, Tobago's chief secretary, the head of its government, and started by asking how serious is the spill.
We have a stretch of coastline of approximately 15 kilometres that's impacted. We pulled the Sentinel maps and we have recognised that the leakage started some 12 kilometres away from the vessel's resting point. We have been into one lagoon that is seriously affected. We are seeing the oil slick along the roots of the mangrove. Notwithstanding, we are seeing signs of resilience. And we also have specialists with wildlife rehabilitation in the area, but we have not had any major impact on wildlife just as yet.
The pictures are pretty alarming. Thick crude washing up on those beaches. Are you going to be able to clean it up, do you think?
Absolutely. In fact, we have one of the areas most impacted with the majority of the crude gone and the rocks still blackened, but we will treat the rocks with the use of our specialists and environmentalists. In fact, what we deployed this morning is the use of these vacuum tanker trucks. These trucks have the capacity to suction out the seaweed, the sargassum, mixed with the oil-like substance, and remove it from the beach. We have skimmers in the water that's separating the oil particles from the water and removing the oil particles.
But this shouldn't have happened in the first place. Do you know why the ship was abandoned? And in fact, who owns the ship?
That's the biggest challenge that we face at the moment, because the area where the IMO number is usually located, that area is covered with the oil-like substance.
Is that an identification number that helps you trace the owner?
Correct. I can give you some things that we have learned. So one, we have discovered that the ship has attached to it a cable which is about a third the length of the vessel, which suggests that that vessel was being towed. The anchor for that vessel is intact, so we know that the vessel did not breach its anchor. So the theory we are working on is that there is a possibility that the vessel was being towed by somebody somewhere. It probably broke from its cable or ran into some kind of difficulty and it was abandoned. I can also tell you that we are expecting by Tuesday representatives of the Oil Spill Response Limited. We being a member, we are getting 5 of the best international experts when it comes to looking at salvaging and also looking at extracting oil from sunken vessels.
But it is pretty outrageous that this was allowed to happen, endangering a series of beaches, wildlife, and at a time when presumably you've got lots of visitors coming to the island. It's carnival, well, isn't it?
I can tell you, it's not only is there carnival, just a stone throw away from one of the cleanup sites. We have a cruise ship in the harbour in Scarborough with over 3,000 passengers. So naturally, as an island, as a government, we are all incensed by it. And we are insistent on finding out what has happened, who owned this vessel, because they must be made to take responsibility for what has transpired. And so we are really going at this with all the resources that we have.
Farley Augustine. Now let's end on camaraderie in the avian world, a story about one little penguin helping out another. A partially sighted penguin at a bird park here in the south of England has found a so-called guide bird to help out at feeding time. Squid, an African penguin, developed cataracts as a chick and needs help when she gets disorientated at feeding time. She gets steered around by another penguin who is just known simply as Penguin. That's because he wasn't given a name at birth because it was thought that he wouldn't survive. Polly Braman from Birdworld says the pair have learnt a lot from each other.
They've developed this relationship from really quite a young age when they both were learning about life in the colony. Penguin, because he had been hand-reared after being very sick and learning how to be a penguin that he hadn't grown up with. And Squid, because she hatched in the nest, she was reared by the parents, but with her sickness and her partially sightedness, she had to learn the beach in a very different way. And they just teamed up, and they've been teamed up ever since. She's very much learnt that she needs to stand next to him at the feed bucket in order to kind of have her focus. And from there, she will very quickly take the fish, but she is definitely much more secure by having him next to her. They're not yet mature. Penguins do tend to pair for life. Whether they will become a pair themselves will be interesting to see. They're compatible as friends, but penguins will have friendships as well. So we will have to see if they form bonds with other penguins as pairs, that could impact this particular friendship. But we don't know. We haven't had the like before.
Polly Braman on the friendship between penguin and squid. OK, that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics that we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And you can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nick Randall. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Thanks for listening. Until next time, goodbye.